Hello, I'm your reader, Paula Carezzi, and it's time for our birthdays. Gordon Allen of Johnston, happy birthday to you. And Donna Mitchell of New Albin, we hope you have a special birthday today. If today is also your birthday and you didn't hear your name, give us a call so we can be sure to get your birthday on our list. Here's a reminder that our program schedule has changed dramatically so that we can get as much local information to as many listeners as possible. The Fort Dodge Messenger will be read at 7 a.m. Monday through Friday. The Mason City Globe Gazette will be read at 8 a.m. Monday through Friday. Your Des Moines Register will continue to be read from 9 a.m. to noon. The Cedar Rapids Gazette will be read at noon, 7 days a week. The Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier will be read at 1 p.m., 7 days a week. The Dubuque Telegraph Herald will be read at 2 p.m., Monday through Friday. The Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil will be read at 3 p.m., Monday through Friday. And the Sioux City Journal will be read at 4 p.m., 7 days a week. The Ames Tribune will be read at 5 p.m., Monday through Friday. The Midweek Shopping Cart will be read each Wednesday at 9 p.m. We will stay with this schedule until further notice. Let's get back to the news by turning to today's USA Today. Among the coronavirus updates, Jessica Menden of USA Today reports Dow drops 730 points, caps week with losses as virus cases surge. Stocks capped a volatile week with steep losses Friday as coronavirus cases in the U.S. surged to a daily record, dimming the prospects of a quick economic recovery after some states paused their reopening efforts in the wake of more outbreaks. Investors are looking ahead to a possible rebound from the deepest global downturn since the 1930s and trying to buy companies that will thrive after the pandemic ends, analysts say. But they warn the market rise might be too fast and too early to be sustained by an uncertain economic outlook. The Dow Jones Industrial Average shed 730.05 points, or 2.8%, to 25,015.55, erasing all of Thursday's gain. It's after the blue chip average jumped 300 points as regulators loosened some financial regulations on banks. Mike Stucca reports infections up in some hot areas. New coronavirus infections are surging in some of America's hottest places. Florida on Friday became the second state after New York to report more than 8,900 new cases in a single day. But New York's high was back in April. That report came as Florida neared an all-time heat record. Sun-baked Texas and Arizona are also getting hit particularly hard by coronavirus. Outside the U.S., crippling outbreaks are underway in such sweltering places as India and Mexico. President Donald J. Trump suggested several times starting last winter that coronavirus would dissipate as warm temperatures came in April. Quote, the virus that we're talking about having to do, a lot of people think that goes away in April. With the heat, as the heat comes in, typically that will go away in April, Trump told governors in February, the New York Times reported. Instead, April was the deadliest month, claiming the lives of 57,723 Americans, Johns Hopkins University data indicate. Stacy Barkinger and Mike Stucca report New Jersey says 1,854 additional residents likely died of coronavirus. New Jersey added 1,854 people to its official toll after counting them as probable COVID-19 deaths. The deaths occurred throughout the pandemic, but all the previously uncounted fatalities were included in Thursday's total, creating an artificial one-day spike in national death numbers. Quote, we report this out of nothing else than a solemn sense of duty, Governor Phil Murphy said Thursday. Quote, for many families, we hope these determinations will provide a sense of closure and of finally knowing. For our state, I hope it steels our resolve to do all that we can to save every single life that we can save, end quote. The state previously counted lab-confirmed cases. The newly released numbers add people whose deaths included COVID-19, SARS-CoV-2, or novel coronavirus on the death certificates. They also include people who died in known outbreaks, like those in nursing homes, but without tests, and people who received an early but no longer accepted coronavirus test, Gannett, New Jersey reported. On Wednesday, data reported from Johns Hopkins University said America recorded 754 deaths in one day, With New Jersey's deaths reported Thursday, the count leaped to 2,425. Though relatively few of those deaths actually occurred recently, it's the single largest increase in coronavirus deaths since April 29th in the Johns Hopkins data. Rebecca Plevin and Mark Oledi of the Palm Springs Desert Sun report, California urges one county to reinstitute stay-at-home order. Governor Gavin Newsom is urging Imperial County to, quote, pull back, end quote, and reinstate its stay-at-home order amid a surge in positive coronavirus tests there and through much of the state. About 23% of people in the Southern California county, which borders the Mexican state of Baja California, are positive for COVID-19, according to Dr. Sonia Angel, director of the California Department of Public Health and state health officer. That rate is, quote, particularly concerning, Angel said Friday afternoon. The state places counties on a watch list if more than 10% of people test positive. And Jeff Zilgit reports 16 NBA players test positive for COVID-19. 16 NBA players of 302 tested positive for the coronavirus, the NBA and National Basketball Players Association said in a joint news release Friday. Quote, any player who tested positive will remain in self-isolation until he satisfies public health protocols for discontinuing isolation and has been cleared by a physician, both organizations said in a statement. Teams started mandatory testing for players Tuesday, and Denver's Nikola Jokic, Indiana's Malcolm Brogdon, and Sacramento's Jabari Parker were among those who have tested positive. Trump administration extends funding for testing sites in Texas. The federal government will continue to fund community testing sites across Texas as the state sees record-breaking increases in new daily coronavirus cases, Governor Greg Abbott announced in a press statement Friday. The Trump administration had planned to end federal funding of 13 coronavirus testing sites in 5 states on June 30th in favor of a, quote, more substantial model, end quote, done in coordination with the states and retail and pharmacy partnerships, according to a senior administration official earlier this week. The sites in Colorado, Pennsylvania, Illinois, New Jersey, and Texas were originally expected to stop receiving funding in May, but received a 30-day extension. Texas is home to 7 of the states. Elizabeth Wise and Karen Weintraub report, task force urges adults under 40 to act more responsibly. Pence doesn't wear face mask. Administration officials pleaded with adults under 40 on Friday to act responsibly to help prevent the spread of COVID-19. In the first public meeting of the White House Coronavirus Task Force since late April, several administration officials said the rising number of cases in states like Florida, Texas, and Arizona suggests that younger adults are not following public health guidance for containing the COVID-19 outbreak. Healthy young people are less likely to suffer the worst symptoms of COVID-19, but they can still infect others. Numbers suggest that everyone who catches the virus infects at least one other person, said Dr. Anthony Fauci, director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases. And some of those people will be vulnerable to breathing struggles, organ failure, immune overreaction, and even death from COVID-19, he said. Vice President Mike Pence did not wear a face mask during the news conference. Health officials in attendance, including Fauci, wore masks except when speaking at the microphone. Among today's top stories is one by Christine Phillips of USA Today titled, Attorney General Barr Creates Task Force to Investigate Anti-Government Extremists. Attorney General William Barr has created a task force to investigate anti-government extremists that officials said were responsible for instigating violence and disrupting peaceful protests over the death of George Floyd. Barr, in a memo Friday, said there is evidence that extremists belonging to the far-right so-called Boogaloo movement and those who identify as Antifa, a loosely organized anti-fascist group, are responsible for some of the violence that marred protests across the country. Barr also said some of the extremists may have had some support from foreign entities, although he did not offer evidence. Quote, although these extremists profess a variety of ideologies, they are united in their opposition to the core constitutional values of a democratic society governed by law, Barr said. Barr said the task force will obtain information about extremist groups, their networks, and movements. quote, the ultimate goal of the task force will not be to enable prosecution of extremists to engage in violence, but to understand these groups well enough that we can stop such violence before it occurs and ultimately eliminate it as a threat to public safety and the rule of law, end quote. The Justice Department has charged a number of people in connection with violence that happened at protests. Earlier this month, federal authorities in Nevada charged three men associated with the Boogaloo movement with conspiracy to cause destruction during demonstrations in Las Vegas. Officials have offered no information linking suspects to Antifa. In an interview with NPR, Barr said investigators don't arrest people for being a member of the far-left movement. Quote, we charge them for throwing a Molotov cocktail, or we charge them for possession of a gun, or possession of gasoline and things to make bombs with, Barr said. Quote, those are the kinds of charges that are filed, even less sensational charges such as battery. But we are building, we are obtaining information and intelligence about the operations of these people, end quote. Barr tapped Craig Carpenito and Aylin Neely Cox, the federal chief prosecutors in New Jersey and in Texas's Northern District, respectively, to lead the task force. Last week, Barr announced that Carpenito will serve as acting U.S. attorney in Manhattan following the resignation of Jeffrey Berman. But Berman refused to resign, creating an extraordinary clash over control of one of the Justice Department's most prestigious offices. The standoff ended after Trump fired Berman. Barr then backtracked from his temporary appointment of Carpenito and allowed Berman's deputy to take his place until a successor is confirmed by the Senate. In other political news, Savannah Behrman of USA Today reports 1,700 troops will support Trump's 4th of July celebration plans, Pentagon says. The Pentagon announced Friday that for the second year in a row, the Department of Defense will provide troops and substantial support to President Donald Trump's expanded Independence Day celebrations. Approximately 1,700 troops will provide support to the Department of the Interior with so-called Salute to America celebrations in Washington, D.C., as well as flyovers of other cities, including New York, Boston, Baltimore, Philadelphia, and the Mount Rushmore National Memorial, Lieutenant Colonel Chris Mitchell, a Pentagon spokesman, said in a statement. Quote, the highlight of this year's celebration will be our salute to the great cities of the American Revolution, Mitchell said. The flyovers will begin in Boston and proceed to New York City, Philadelphia, and Baltimore. From there, they will join other Department of Defense and heritage aircraft in the salute to America over our nation's capital, end quote. The statement did not specify which aircraft would be showcased, but it added that, quote, flying hours are a sunk cost for the Department of Defense, and these aircraft and crews would be using these hours for proficiency and training at other locations if they were not conducting these flyovers, end quote. Quote, the exact timing of the flyovers is still being worked and will be announced soon, the statement reads. Last year's celebration involved flyovers of the F-35 Joint Strike Fighter, B-2 Stealth Bomber, and F-22 Raptor. The nation's capital last year also rumbled with tanks, and Trump's demand they be part of his so-called Salute to America on the National Mall prompted criticism. The announcement of the troops' assistance comes one day after a new report from the Government Accountability Office said that Trump's elaborate Independence Day celebrations last year in D.C. cost double that of previous years, ringing up $13 million in taxpayer dollars. Much of that increase was, quote, attributable to the cost for the Department of Defense to transport several vehicles to the National Mall, end quote, and, quote, the production and execution of the Salute to America event, end quote, according to the GAO. While D.C.'s annual parade has been canceled this year amid coronavirus concerns, the president is currently planning to push ahead with modified plans for a July 4th celebration in the Capitol, despite objections from lawmakers. They have expressed worry about crowds gathering amid the health crisis and the cost during a turbulent economy. Last year's cost was, quote, played for primarily with annual federal appropriations, end quote. White House spokesperson Judd Deere told USA Today that the event, quote, will have a different look than 2019 to ensure the health and safety of those attending, end quote. The White House announced Trump, quote, will host the 2020 Salute to America on the South Lawn of the White House and Ellipse this year, end quote. And an AP story published in USA Today Online quotes a judge, U.S. must free migrant children from family detention. A federal judge on Friday ordered the release of children held with their parents in U.S. immigration jails and denounced the Trump administration's prolonged detention of families during the coronavirus pandemic. U.S. District Judge Dolly Gee's order applies to children held for more than 20 days at three family detention centers in Texas and Pennsylvania operated by U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement. Some have been detained since last year. Citing the recent spread of the virus in two of the three facilities, Gee set a deadline of July 17th for children to either be released with their parents or sent to family sponsors. The family detention centers, quote, are on fire and there is no more time for half measures, she wrote. In May, ICE said it was detaining 184 children at the three detention centers, which are separate from U.S. Department of Health and Human Services facilities for unaccompanied children that were holding around 1,000 children in early June. The numbers in both systems have fallen significantly since earlier in the Trump administration because the U.S. is expelling most people trying to cross the border or requiring them to wait for their immigration cases in Mexico. Gee oversees a long-running court settlement governing the U.S. government's treatment of immigrant children known as the Flores Agreement. Her order does not directly apply to the parents detained with their children. But most parents last month refused to designate a sponsor when ICE officials unexpectedly asked them who could take their children if adults remained detained, according to lawyers for the families. The agency said then it was conducting a, quote, routine parole review consistent with the law, end quote, and Gee's previous orders. Advocates contend that ICE should release all families from detention, especially as the coronavirus has spread rapidly through immigration detention. In court filings revealed Thursday, ICE said 11 children and parents have tested positive for COVID-19 at the Family Detention Center in Karnes City, Texas. At the detention center in nearby Dilley, at least three parents and children, including a child who turned two this week, were placed in isolation after two private contractors and an ICE official tested positive for the virus. Amy Maldonado, an attorney who works with detained families, said Gee, quote, clearly recognized that the government is not willing to protect the health and safety of the children, which is their obligation, end quote. Quote, they need to make the sensible choice and release the parents to care for their children, she said of the government. For most people, the new coronavirus case causes mild or moderate symptoms, such as fever and cough, that clear up in 2 to 3 weeks. For some, especially older adults and people with existing health problems, it can cause more severe illness, including pneumonia and death. The vast majority of people recover. More than 2,500 people in ICE custody have tested positive for COVID-19. The agency says it has released at least 900 people considered to have heightened medical risk and reduced the populations at its three family detention centers. But in court filings last month, ICE said it considered most of the people in family detention to be flight risks because they had pending deportation orders or cases under review. Autumn Schulman of USA Today reports, investigators solve 1982 murder of 8-year-old Ohio girl, link DNA to dead killer. Nearly 40 years ago, 8-year-old Kelly Prosser left her elementary school in Columbus, Ohio. She never arrived home. 2 days later, she was found dead in a cornfield in a case that puzzled the community and police for decades. But on Friday, her family finally got an answer about who killed the child. Columbus police investigators, who never gave up on the cold case, matched a dead man's DNA to the rape and murder of Kelly. Quote, our family has spent many long years waiting for Kelly Ann's murder to be solved, according to a statement released by Kelly's family after police announced the news. Quote, but Kelly's family is not unique. Those who have suffered the murder of their loved one knows how devastating waiting for answers can be. Nor are we the only family who has laid awake at night hoping and praying that their missing child would return home safely, end quote. Kelly Prosser was abducted while walking home from Indianola Elementary School on September 20, 1982. Her body was discovered in nearby Madison County 2 days later. Authorities said she had been beaten, sexually assaulted, and strangled. On Friday afternoon during a press conference, police said DNA identifies now-deceased Harold Warren Jarrell as the man behind the killing. Jarrell passed away in 1996 at the age of 67 in Las Vegas. The case was pronounced closed Friday when Columbus police said a new genealogical testing technique identified the girl's killer. Detectives recently began working with a genealogy company called Advanced DNA to use DNA from the crime scene to identify the suspect. They were able to establish a family tree and followed up on leads with possible family members. The initial family match was with a third cousin. Through this process, they determined that Gerald was Kelly's killer. Genetic genealogy testing and research has solved a number of high-profile cold cases nationally in recent years, including California's so-called Golden State Killer. Detective Dana Kroom, who took over the case fully in 2016, said at a news press conference that he, quote, "couldn't believe it when we got the match. I was numb and I teared up a little bit," end quote. He said he has a personal connection with the family and thought of his own kids as he worked the case. Quote, "all of these years of this case being open and numerous detectives working on it, it is satisfying to let the family know what happened to their little girl, though it doesn't bring her back. There are cases that stick with detectives forever, and this is one of those for all of us," said Kroom, according to ABC6. Columbus police said their podcast helped get answers in Kelly's case. Columbus police started a podcast in May titled The Fifth Floor in hopes to find Prosser's killer and tell her story. Her case was chosen for the series because it is one every detective and investigator that has worked on the case has felt a personal connection with and a desire to close, said Columbus Deputy Chief Greg Bodker. Prosser's family had no known connection to Gerald, Bodker said. Quote, "this appears to be a true stranger abduction," he said. Quote, "I don't know that his name would have come up without the DNA," Bodker said. Quote, "Gerald was not on our radar at all as someone who committed this murder," end quote. Gerald had been convicted in 1977 of a sex crime involving a child in Columbus and served about 5 years in prison, Bodker said. Quote, "his DNA profile has been in CODIS, the Combined DNA Index System, since it started," he said. Quote, "if there was any other evidence in other crimes, it would have generated a hit," end quote. Doyle Rice of USA Today reports, the Sahara dust storm has reached the U.S. mainland. A huge plume of dust and sand blown by the wind from the Sahara Desert has finally reached the U.S. mainland. It's one of the most significant Saharan dust events in decades, forecasters said. The densest plume of dust began to emerge off western Africa last weekend and has now moved into the Gulf of Mexico and the south, the Weather Channel said. The mass of extremely dry and dusty air, known as the Saharan air layer, forms over the Sahara Desert and moves across the North Atlantic every 3 to 5 days from late spring to early fall, peaking in late June to mid-August, according to the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. It can occupy a roughly 2-mile thick layer in the atmosphere, the agency said. Quote, "the main impacts of the Saharan dust are a whitening of the sky during daylight hours, redder sunsets, and decreased air quality," the National Weather Service said. Ryan W. Miller of USA Today reports, Elijah McClain was injected with ketamine before he died. Is that legal? Amid calls for justice for Elijah McClain, a 23-year-old black man who died after he was stopped by police in Aurora, Colorado, was placed in a carotid hold by an officer. The use of ketamine during his arrest has also drawn scrutiny. McClain's family says he was walking home last August when officers responded to a call of a suspicious person acting erratically. Colorado Governor Jared Polis on Thursday appointed a special prosecutor to re-examine the case following intense public pressure and an online petition that garnered more than 3 million signatures. Adams County District Attorney Dave Young's office declined to file criminal charges in November, but in the wake of the killings of George Floyd, Ahmaud Arbery, Breonna Taylor, and Rayshard Brooks, there has been renewed interest in McClain's case. An autopsy was unable to determine whether McClain's death was an accident due to natural causes or a homicide. However, medical and legal experts told USA Today that the injection of ketamine may have played a role. In medical settings, ketamine is routinely used for its rapid and anesthetic effects, but it is also used illicitly as a hallucinogen. Here's what to know about the use of the drug during arrests and its risks. Can ketamine or other sedatives be used during an arrest? Yes, said Jeffrey Henley, a Dallas attorney in the case of Tony Timpa, who died during an arrest in which officers pinned his shoulders, knees, and neck to the ground as he pleaded for help. Timpa was also dosed with a sedative. Henley said, citing precedent from previous cases, that paramedics or other emergency medical professionals are generally allowed and protected under qualified immunity principles to administer sedatives to patients during an arrest following proper medical judgments. In general, past cases have not established clearly that using sedatives during an arrest is an example of excessive force, Henley said. Henley said administering sedatives is often the protocol in some cases during which officers are subduing someone they believe to be resisting arrest. The goal is to prevent the person from struggling and thrashing, which can cause injury or distress and elevate their heart rate. Quote, it's unfortunate and it's tragic, Henley said. Quote, with respect to the ketamine, it very well may have been reckless by the EMTs. I wonder about that, but I think it's going to be difficult to make such a claim, end quote. Although rare, it is also possible that someone's adrenaline levels rise so high during an arrest that it causes cardiac arrest, said Dr. Douglas Zipes, a professor of medicine at Indiana University. According to Aurora Fire Rescue's department policy, ketamine is considered appropriate to administer to a patient who shows signs of, quote, excited delirium, end quote, a condition characterized by aggressive activity, confused and unconnected thoughts or speech, hallucinations, and extraordinary strength and endurance when struggling. According to a flowchart of the department's policy, the, quote, goal is rapid tranquilization in order to minimize time struggling, end quote. But so-called excited delirium isn't a recognized diagnosis in the American Psychiatric Association's leading diagnostic manual, commonly known as the DSM, or the International Classification of Diseases, ICD-9, of the World Health Organization. The American College of Emergency Physicians and the National Association of Medical Examiners do recognize it. For decades, critics have pointed to the fact that the term is applied almost exclusively to in-custody deaths or deaths that otherwise involve law enforcement. Why was Elijah McClain arrested, injected with ketamine? On August 24, 2019, the Aurora Police Department received a call around 10:30 p.m. about a so-called suspicious man wearing a ski mask, according to a release. Officers arrived and tried to stop McClain, who they said was, quote, actively resisting, end quote, and trying to grab one of their guns. McClain told the officers that he was going home and asked that they, quote, please respect my boundaries, end quote. Police said McClain had ignored their initial command to stop, but McClain told the officers he was stopping his music so he could listen, according to a report of the incident from the district attorney's office. Police put McClain in a carotid hold, applying pressure around his neck, restricting blood flow to the brain. McClain briefly went unconscious. According to the district attorney's report, the Aurora Fire Department was called to the scene per police policy for when a carotid hold is used. When fire personnel and medics arrived at the scene of McClain's arrest, a fire medic requested that McClain be injected with ketamine to sedate him. Fire medic Jeremy Cooper told investigators that he requested ketamine following the fire department's protocol for when someone shows signs of, quote, excited delirium, end quote. The district attorney's report says that Cooper requested 500 milligrams of ketamine. In a statement, Aurora Fire Rescue said an investigation into its personnel's actions during McClain's arrest found that, quote, the actions of the responders were consistent and aligned with our established protocols. In fact, the initial findings indicate that our personnel demonstrated a high level of technical skill and professionalism while providing care to the patient, end quote. The report from the Adams County Coroner's Office could not make a conclusion on what caused McClain's death. The report said it was possible McClain had, quote, an idiosyncratic drug reaction, end quote, which can occur when a drug is administered at therapeutic levels but still has an unexpected reaction. His death could have been due to natural causes if he, quote, had an undiagnosed mental illness that led to excited delirium, end quote, or homicide could have been the cause if the carotid hold led to arrhythmia, the report said. The report also listed several contributing factors, including the combination of intense physical exertion and a narrow left coronary artery. Is ketamine dangerous in these cases? Ketamine, under appropriate dosage levels with otherwise healthy patients, is generally considered safe, said Dr. Robert Glattner, an emergency physician in New York City. but there are circumstances under which administering ketamine could have adverse and potentially lethal effects, including if a patient has hypoxia or low oxygen levels, is dehydrated, or has low blood pressure, Glatter said. The use of the carotid hold in combination with the ketamine injection could have created, quote, dangerous conditions, end quote, from a claim, Glatter said. These drugs do carry risks, and with certain types of patients under certain types of stressors, they can have adverse consequences and they can be lethal, he added. Zipes, who reviewed the district attorney's and coroner's report, cited a number of possible complications that can cause health issues when ketamine is used during an arrest. Injecting the drug too quickly or without proper monitoring, an unknown medical history, and possible interactions with other substances in the patient's system. The coroner's report says McLean was also found to have marijuana in his system. Quote, no one can really say with absolute certainty what the cause was. My gut is it's related to the ketamine, Zipes said. Now let's turn to the opinion section of today's Des Moines Register. In a Your Turn column, written by State Representative Chuck Eisenhart, a Democrat from Dubuque, we learn, aid vulnerable Iowans with unspent COVID-19 funds. On their way out of the Capitol after the legislative session, Iowa House Republicans tacked a resolution to the door, quote, recognizing the leadership of President Trump and Governor Reynolds during the COVID-19 pandemic, end quote. The 12-paragraph document urged the governor to adopt a detailed spending plan for the disbursement of Iowa's $1.25 billion share of federal coronavirus relief. As of June 22nd, she has announced less than $100 million in allocations, including $70 million for small business assistance, $25 million for eviction and foreclosure prevention, and $3.5 million in food aid. The resolution signed by all 53 Republicans was not presented for adoption. Such bills are subject to amendment and debate. The House majority was apparently not interested in publicly discussing how Iowa should use emergency resources equal to 16% of the state's general fund budget, much less require legislative oversight of the spending. House Appropriations Committee Chair Gary Moore rejected Democratic proposals as, quote, not germane, end quote, to the budget. Assistance to community health centers, personal protective equipment for schools, and more resources for mental health regions, domestic violence prevention, and early childhood grants. The result? Little legislative acknowledgement of or response to the pandemic. Also ignored were ideas I offered in an amendment developed after comparing notes with legislative colleagues whose communities have suffered COVID-19 outbreaks. In my district, outbreaks have infected the Dubuque County Jail, devastated a long-term care facility, and rampaged through a vulnerable minority community. We consulted with Ann Kinzel, a public health policy expert. Once employed by the Iowa Department of Public Health, she is now chair of the board of the Iowa Caregivers Association. Among our proposals, fund the Department of Public Health to hire community-based contact tracers fluent in multiple languages to meet the staffing levels recommended by the Centers for Disease Control. Also, fund the Department of Human Rights to hire 20 healthcare emergency advocates for minority, migrant, disabled, non-English-speaking, and other at-risk populations to ensure that such persons receive all assistance to which they are entitled, including access to testing services and housing for diagnosed individuals, to mitigate the spread of infection. One advocate should be located at each community action agency, and three state advocates should be deployed to communities where major outbreaks occur. Advocates hired under this provision should be multilingual and, whenever possible, come from one of the populations they will be serving. Also, fund the Iowa Long-Term Care Ombudsman Office to hire sufficient personnel to serve facilities at risk for infectious disease outbreak so that each facility can be visited on-site at least 4 times a year, as well as each time a complaint is received for which an on-site visit is necessary to ensure appropriate fact-finding and evaluation. Also, fund the Department of Workforce Development to ensure sick leave and health benefits for any worker diagnosed with COVID-19 employed at a residential care facility, other health or child care facility, or any place of work defined as essential so that workers can remain in isolation until they are able to return to work per public health guidelines without sacrificing income. Also, fund the Department of Public Health to get professional private sector help for public outreach and messaging campaigns to support COVID-19 prevention, mitigation, and response measures, with 50% of funds earmarked for counties with outbreaks to support local public communication efforts. Also, fund the Department of Workforce Development to distribute hazard pay to workers at residential care facilities with COVID-19 outbreaks. And finally, fund the state medical assistance program to extend coverage to people residing in Iowa, according to the Compacts of Free Association, who are otherwise ineligible for health care coverage until the federal government restores their eligibility under the Medicaid program. Working with Ms. Kinzel and others, we developed and shared detailed rationales to support these recommendations. Yet we were under no illusion that the proposals would be included in the state budget. Governors don't like pesky legislators dictating to them how to use discretionary authority. Governors don't want to veto funding the public might support. Instead, the governor now has these proposals in a letter sent directly to her. She can take one, some, or all of them based on their merits. Anyone with good ideas for how $1 billion can be intelligently parceled out to save lives, protect workers, sustain social and economic life, and help manage Iowa through this pandemic can, quote, tack the ideas on her door, end quote, by emailing the governor's chief of staff, Sarah Craig, at sarah.craig@iowa.gov. Again, this is a Your Turn column written by State Representative Chuck Eisenhart, a Democrat from Dubuque who represents Iowa House District 100. In letters to the editor, Glenn Grotlishan of Jefferson writes, U.S. at Turning Point, Memorializing History. The phrase, quote, those who do not learn from history are doomed to repeat it, end quote, has been used to argue for keeping our symbols of the past just as they are. But what do these symbols represent, and are they a true representation of that history? The Civil War monuments are the most troublesome for society. What led the Southern states to secede from the Union? The states were concerned with preserving states' rights and maintaining an agrarian way of life that included slavery. As we know, these conflicts led to the states to form their own government, to create the Confederate Army, and initiate armed conflict with the northern non-slave states. By definition in the Constitution, this was an act of treason against the United States. Following the war and Reconstruction, a period known as Jim Crow existed until the 1960s. Jim Crow laws legalized racial segregation and were adopted by states of the former Confederacy, along with some additional states. During this period, many statues and monuments were erected of Confederate military and civil leaders. Some would argue these were in remembrances of another time before the Civil War. Some argue they were enacted as reminders of white supremacy. We have to remind ourselves, removing statues and monuments to our troublesome history from public places is not about forgetting the history, but how we choose to memorialize that history. Signed, Glenn Grotlishan of Jefferson. Eileen Nelson of Adel writes, face masks should be as commonplace as shirts and shoes. For as long as I can remember, it's been common to see signs near entrances to establishments that say, no shirt, no shoes, no service. While there is no law requiring wearing a shirt or shoes, it's a standard for the health and safety of patrons. Most customers seem to comply and accept this social norm. It took a law to ban smoking in most public areas for the health of the population. Most smokers comply with the law, and the public is protected from inhaling secondhand smoke and potential illness. In both examples, there is no social, political, sexual, or racial bias intended. Now we are faced with a much larger health issue affecting our population, the coronavirus pandemic. Health experts tell us that COVID-19 is most easily spread through respiratory droplets from infected people, many of whom may be totally asymptomatic. Research shows that wearing a face mask works to contain the spread of the virus. Many establishments require workers to wear masks, and some stores require all customers to wear masks. Sadly, masks have become a political issue rather than a health issue. The only statement not wearing a mask makes is a disregard for others, like blowing smoke in someone's face. Wearing a mask is no more difficult than wearing a shirt and shoes in public. Signed, Eileen Nelson of Adel. In another Your Turn column, Dr. Brian Privet, who is an ophthalmologist from Cedar Rapids, writes, we won't give up on limits to malpractice awards. Medical practices in Iowa are struggling. By now, you've likely heard the stories of how the COVID-19 pandemic has already cost our state's healthcare system hundreds of millions of dollars. What you might not have heard is that before COVID-19, Iowa providers were already facing down another significant financial challenge, a wave of lawsuits deploying questionable tactics to exploit difficult situations and drive up payouts from providers and facilities across the state. These lawsuits oftentimes target rural and independent practices that are the sole source of medical care in their community, and they are having a huge impact. In the past 3 years alone, lawsuits have resulted in a record $85 million in awards against Iowa practices. As a result, practices are forced to max out their professional liability insurance coverage, drain their reserve funds, and make difficult decisions about whether or not they are able to continue providing care in their community. The legislature had an opportunity to help fix the problem this session by enacting a hard cap on non-economic damages in medical liability lawsuits. This would have created guardrails to protect against runaway judgments while ensuring fair compensation for patients when a mistake is made. With several additional high-dollar lawsuits already in the pipeline and the COVID-19 expenses continuing to pile up, these basic protections are more important than ever. That's why it is so disappointing that the Iowa House failed to pass this hard cap. The Iowa Senate and many individual members of the Iowa House should be commended for their tireless work to push for these protections. They understood, now more than ever, that Iowa practices are vulnerable to financial collapse from a single multi-million-dollar lawsuit. COVID-19 has challenged our healthcare delivery system like never before. Practices have lost millions from delaying all but the most urgent medical care in order to help preserve supplies and resources for frontline pandemic response efforts. Many clinics even temporarily closed their doors and went to extreme lengths to keep their own staff on the payroll until federal assistance became available. Now, practices are working to resume regular operations, and they are having to pay a premium for basic supplies like masks and gloves because traditional medical supply lines are still stretched thin, trying to keep up with demand. Practices are also investing in new technologies to provide more medical services remotely, and they're extending hours to catch up on the backlog of delayed care. These financial losses and additional expenses have some practices on the brink of financial ruin. Iowa's unfavorable medical liability climate has already contributed to the closure of some of high-risk services, such as obstetrical care in many rural communities. With the additional strain of COVID-19 and more high-dollar lawsuits on the way, how many more clinics must close before the legislature takes action? Iowa needs a hard cap on non-economic damages to protect the long-term sustainability of healthcare in our state. We look forward to additional conversations with legislators in the coming months. It is my sincere hope that when the General Assembly reconvenes in January, we can finally take action to protect those frontline practices that are working so hard to protect every Iowan. Again, this is a guest column written by Dr. Brian Privett, an ophthalmologist from Cedar Rapids. He is the current president of the Iowa Medical Society. The opinion section of USA Today includes a column by Nancy Kaffer of the Detroit Free Press, titled, "He was arrested because of a computer error. Now he wants to fix the system." When the Detroit Police Department called Robert Williams, he thought it was a prank. The voice on the other end of the line told Williams to turn himself in at the DPD's 3rd Precinct. Why? The cop wouldn't say. Quote, "I can't turn myself in if you can't tell me," Williams recalls saying. Quote, "I said, if you want me, you can come to my house and bring a warrant," end quote. But it was late in his workday, and Williams was disturbed enough to head home, calling his wife Melissa as he drove. When she answered, the cops were already there. What Williams didn't know on that day back in January is that he had been misidentified by the Detroit Police Department's controversial facial recognition technology as a shoplifter who allegedly stole 5 watches from Midtown's trendy Shinola store in October 2018, making him the first person known to have been arrested because of a facial recognition failure. What happened next is baffling. The charges were ultimately dismissed, but not before Williams, aged 42, was arrested, arraigned, detained for 30 hours, and questioned in connection with a crime that took place in a store he hadn't visited since 2014, a humiliating set of events Williams says neither he nor his wife and children have been able to really move past. And none of it had to happen. Facial recognition technology is controversial precisely because of its high error rate in identifying non-white faces. Because for 18 months, the department used it without a publicly vetted Board of Police Commissioners approved operating policy. And because critics fear it shorthands what should be a thorough investigative process. Williams could easily have proved that he wasn't the man in question. He was at work at his job at an automotive supplier when the reported theft happened. But the DPD didn't ask, he said. Instead, officers arrived at his home on a quiet Farmington Hills street, cuffing Williams, who had no criminal record, and placing him into a squad car as his wife and young children watched. Wednesday, Williams, with the ACLU of Michigan and his lawyer, Victoria Burton Harris, filed a complaint with the Detroit police, asking the department and the Wayne County Prosecutor's Office for a series of corrective actions to repair the damage done to Williams' reputation, like removing Williams' image from the facial recognition database and to halt the use of facial recognition technology altogether. The department's contract with facial recognition software provider DataWorks Plus, based in South Carolina, is up for renewal, and ending use of the technology has become an issue in the wave of protests against police brutality. Chief James Craig has contended that facial recognition is used in a thoughtful, deliberative manner, the equivalent of paging through a book of digital mugshots, and that leads are always vetted by a human analyst. In 2019 of August, Craig told reporters on a tour of DPD's real-time crime center that the software had been used 500 times and never resulted in a misidentification. Later that year, the Board of Police Commissioners adopted a policy to govern its use. The department now only uses facial recognition to identify suspects in violent crimes. But none of those policy changes helped Robert Williams. Williams was taken to the Detroit Detention Center, where he was processed and questioned, an experience so surreal that neither he nor Melissa can quite believe it happened. While Williams was in custody, a DPD officer showed him an image taken from Shinola surveillance footage of a black man in a red cap. Quote, "He turns over this picture and says, 'So that's not you?' I laughed a little bit because it looked nothing like me and said, 'Nope, that's not me,' he said. The officer presented two more pictures, neither of Williams. Quote, 'So I guess the computer got it wrong, too,' Williams remembers the officer saying. It was the officer's offhand remark about the computer that led Robert and Melissa Williams to start to understand what had happened, along with the couple's decision to reach out to the ACLU and their ability to hire a defense attorney. Information given at a hearing to Burton Harris, who was running against Wayne County Prosecutor Kim Worthy, fleshed out the timeline, and that's also baffling. The reported theft happened in October 2018. Williams was misidentified by facial recognition software in March 2019. In July of that year, a Shinola security guard who had seen only footage of the theft identified Williams in a photo lineup. In January 2020, Williams was arrested. Detroit police offered the following statement Wednesday. Quote, "Due to the fact that this case is pending litigation, we cannot comment further. The Detroit Police Department does not make arrests based solely on facial recognition. Facial recognition software is an investigative tool that is used to generate leads only. Additional investigative work, corroborating evidence, and probable cause are required before an arrest can be made," end quote. The ACLU said Wednesday that it had only filed a complaint with the department, not a lawsuit. Worthy notes that it was her office that opted to dismiss the charges once a review of the case revealed that there was insufficient evidence. And Worthy says she opposes the use of facial recognition software. Quote, "In the summer of 2019, Detroit Police Department asked me personally to adopt their facial recognition policy. I declined and cited studies regarding the unreliability of the software, especially as it relates to people of color. They are well aware of my stance and my position remains the same," she said in a statement. Worthy said her office requires review by a supervisor and corroborating evidence for any case that uses the technology. Quote, "This present case occurred prior to this policy. Nevertheless, this case should not have been issued based on the DPD investigation, and for that we apologize. Thankfully, it was dismissed on our office's own motion. This does not in any way make up for the hours that Mr. Williams spent in jail, Worthy said in the statement. Burton Harris says Worthy's office and DPD have either delayed or ignored requests for information about Williams' case. The charges against Williams were dismissed without prejudice, which means the case can technically be reopened. Burton Harris says the prosecutor's office should dismiss with prejudice, meaning the case is closed, but Worthy's office said that's not legally possible unless, quote, the statute of limitations has expired, or there is a legal bar to reauthorization, such as double jeopardy, end quote. ACLU attorney Phil Mayer said that while this is the first known case of a facial recognition misidentification, he doesn't think it's the only case. Williams, he notes, had the resources to fight it. Quote, I think they need to do actual investigative work and not rely on a flawed computer system that's racist and biased, Melissa Williams said. Quote, I thought there were some steps before they came to your house to arrest you, end quote. Melissa Williams says she's a fan of cop shows, where determining a suspect's alibi consumes a lot of the action. But they didn't ask her husband for an alibi, she said. Quote, and he had one. That could have cleared some things up, end quote. Robert Williams vividly remembers the day of his only visit to Detroit's Shinola store back in 2014. Melissa Williams' brother had just moved to Midtown Detroit and was eager to show his family the neighborhood, particularly the trendy Midtown shop. The family, Robert and Melissa, their new baby, and Melissa's brother and mother, walked down to browse the watches and bicycles the store is known for. He didn't buy anything. A watch enthusiast, Robert Williams prefers to wear a Breitling. But it was a fun family outing. They took pictures. He's never been back. That Williams was charged with a crime, even though those charges are dismissed, will show up in a simple background check. He had to explain to his employer what happened, and he has to live with the humiliation of having been arrested in his front lawn for all the world to see. Quote, we live in a nice neighborhood. My neighbors, one lady works for the Farmington Hills Treasury Office. The man across the street is an evidence tech in the suburbs police department. Then the people next door to me are teachers. And all of this happens at 5:30 in the evening while everybody's home. And by the way, I'm the black guy on the street. So when there's a Detroit police car sitting on the street, they know who he's there for. End quote. Robert and Melissa Williams say they and their children are still struggling to understand why this happened. Quote, I'm not a thief. I do fairly well, Robert Williams said. All I know for a fact is that I was arrested for no reason. End quote. In another opinion column in USA Today, Robert Robb of the Arizona Republic writes, Supreme Court was supposed to protect the separation of powers. Instead, it killed them. In our national government, the separation of powers is a dead letter. That's the doctrine underpinning the United States Constitution, holding that the powers of the three branches of our government are distinct and the powers of one are not to be exercised by the others. The founders believed that the separation of powers and the system of checks and balances it produces were a bulwark of individual liberty, a way of keeping government within the constraints the founders intended. So, if the separation of powers is a dead letter, what does that mean? For our system of government? For the constraints that protect individual liberty? These questions are sparked by two recent U.S. Supreme Court decisions, one giving a stay of execution for the Obama administration's legalization program for Dreamers, those brought to this country illegally as children, and the other expanding protected classes for employment discrimination to include sexual orientation and gender identity. Immigration is Congress's responsibility. The Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals decision, dealing with legal status for those brought here illegally as children, offers the fullest illustration. The Constitution clearly gives authority over immigration to Congress. And, over the years, Congress has passed highly detailed and prescriptive laws about who can legally be in this country. But Congress has stalled out regarding what to do with millions of people who are residing in the country illegally, but otherwise are law-abiding and productive. I favor giving them amnesty in conjunction with reforms, principally making electronic verification of work eligibility mandatory, that would sharply reduce the incidence of future illegal immigration. The Obama administration issued a memorandum establishing an amnesty program for the Dreamers. They would be deemed legally present and could legally work based upon 2-year renewable permits. The Trump administration believed, correctly in my judgment, that the executive branch had no constitutional authority to create what amounted to a new category of legal immigration. It chose to wind down the program the very same way the Obama administration created it, by issuing a memorandum. The Supreme Court, in another sophistic opinion written by Chief Justice John Roberts, held that the Trump administration had no authority to act on its own understanding of the limits of executive branch authority, or to undo what the Obama administration did in precisely the same way the Obama administration did it. Instead, the Trump administration had to go through the hoops of the Administrative Procedure Act and come up with other reasons that would satisfy the justices. We now have a power free-for-all. Consider this spectacle from the perspective of the separation of powers. President A establishes a new category of legal immigration. President B abolishes it. The U.S. Supreme Court arbitrates and prevents President B from undoing President A's new legal immigration category without going through some legal hoops and coming up with different reasons for doing so. So, we have the executive branch and the judicial branch determining immigration policy for the U.S., a responsibility the U.S. Constitution gives unambiguously to the legislative branch. The employment discrimination decision was, as Justice Samuel Alito described it in dissent, a transparent act of legislating. Federal law prohibits discrimination on the basis of sex, which was understood at the time to mean biological sex, for being a man or a woman. Congress has debated adding bans on discrimination because of sexual orientation or gender identity, but hasn't yet done so. No need. The Supreme Court did it for them in a remarkably pettifogging opinion by Justice Neil Gorsuch, masquerading as an originalist and a textualist. The problem is deeper than the Supreme Court usurping legislative authority from Congress, which is nothing new, or the court protecting executive branch usurpation of the immigration policy-making authority of Congress. Congress itself has violated the separation of powers doctrine massively by setting up regulatory agencies that exercise both legislative and judicial functions. And Congress has invited usurpations by being so dysfunctional. One of the responsibilities the founders did assign to and expect of the Supreme Court was to protect and police separation of powers. And these two cases confirm that ain't going to happen. So we are in the process of learning what it means to have a national government in which the allocation of power and authority is a free-for-all. I doubt that it will be an improvement on what the founders intended and thought they had crafted. Robert Robb is an editorial columnist for the Arizona Republic, where this column originally appeared. And that's it for our second hour of the Register on IRIS. We're so glad to have you listening. I'm your reader, Paula Carrezzi. Coming up next, obituaries from the Des Moines Register.
Your prescription will be ready in just a minute. Hey, Dad, your laundry will be ready in just a minute. Dad, your lunch will be ready in just a minute.
Hey, honey, why don't you take a minute?
When you help care for a loved one, you give them as much time as you can, making sure they're safe and comfortable. But it's just as important that you take some time for yourself. At AARP, we can help with information and useful tips on how you can maintain a healthy life balance, care for your own physical and mental well-being, and manage the challenges of caring for a loved one. Because the better care you take of yourself, the better care you can provide for your loved one.
Thanks, Dad.
Thank you. You're there for them. We're here for you. Find free care guides to support you and your loved one at aarp.org/caregiving. That's aarp.org/caregiving. Public service announcement brought to you by AARP and the Ad Council.